This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. My name is Nigella Hillgarth and I'm the Executive Director here at the Aquarium. And it's my great pleasure this evening to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Andreas Anderson. And Dr. Anderson has authored or co-authored approximately 35 scientific peer-reviewed articles on ocean acidification and one book on the subject. So he's a really, really good person to tell us about some of the problems about ocean acidification and coral reefs this evening. He is a scientist here at Scripps. He was born and brought up in Sweden, and he later relocated to Hawaii, sensible guy, perhaps it was the weather, to attend college and later graduate school. Don't get me wrong, I love Sweden, but it is warmer in Hawaii. He holds a BS in marine biology from Hawaii Pacific University. He was valedictorian of the class of 2001. And he got a master's and a PhD in chemical oceanography from the School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And after completion of his PhD, he spent several years in Bermuda at the Bermuda Institute of Ocean Sciences before becoming part of the faculty at SIO in the summer of 2011. And Anderson's general research interest deals with global environmental change owing to both natural and anthropogenic processes and the subsequent effects on the function, the role, and the cycling of carbon in marine environments. His current research is mainly concerned with ocean acidification in coral reefs and in nearshore coastal environments. Please join me in welcoming Andreas for his presentation titled Coral Reefs and Ocean Acidification.
Introduction. So I want to talk about four things today. I want to talk about what is ocean acidification, why are we concerned about ocean acidification, what are some of the approaches we use to try to understand how ocean acidification will affect coral reefs, and then finally I will talk a little bit about the tools my lab is using to address ocean acidification. As you heard from the introduction, I'm from Sweden. The weather is indeed miserable in Sweden. It's very cold. I was from about just north of 60 degrees north, and it's about the same latitude as Fairbanks, Alaska. And quite frequently we experience temperatures about minus 40 degrees. So when I was old enough to make my own decisions, I moved to Hawaii. That was a very wise decision. I actually had, first time I experienced the coral reefs was in when I was 21 years old. And I had served in the Swedish Navy for 2 years. And once I finished, I bought a round the world ticket and I went to Tonga, of all places, because I had always dreamt about exploring the South Pacific. And that was the first time I put on a mask and a snorkel, and I dove into something like this, and I discovered the world of a coral reefs, and I was totally blown away. I could never imagine what I would see under there, and it literally changed my life. And I think that day is the reason I'm here today. And after serving in the Navy, I actually never thought I would work with the ocean again, because I was seasick every time we left port. So I'm quite surprised I ended up where I am, but I love my job. When you look at a picture like this, it's pretty easy to appreciate the beauty and the diversity of the coral reefs. But we may still question, why are they important? Or why should anyone in Kansas care about coral reefs? Kansas being landlocked. So coral reefs, they have an unprecedented biodiversity, and sometimes we refer to them as the rainforest of the oceans. About 25% of all the known marine fish species, they live on a coral reef. There are more than 500 million people in the world that are completely dependent on the coral reef for food and nutrition, the revenue from fisheries and tourism, protection from storms and waves. And the estimated value of the services that coral reefs globally provide is about 170 billion per year. There are many different estimates, but this is probably one of the more recent ones. So coral reefs are so much more than just beautiful. And if someone is still not convinced, they should talk to this guy here that I met in Palau on a dive boat. And he's from Kansas. And what you can see here in his t-shirt, Dive Kansas. And there's a diver sharing a little water tub here with a cow. So, coral reefs are beautiful. And when you talk to people who do research on coral reefs, you always see all these spectacular pictures of corals and the different inhabitants of a reef. My line of research, though, I must admit, is not that glamorous. I actually study carbon. Okay, so this is what I'm more interested in. And this is essentially the cycling of carbon on a coral reef. So how carbon at the top here, as carbon dioxide, is taken up by organisms through photosynthesis to build organic carbon, okay? And also how that organic carbon is transferred back to CO2 through respiration, so the breakdown of the organic matter. And then on the other side, we have the process of calcification, so how carbon is taken up to form calcium carbonate. And this is what forms the reef structure, the skeleton of the corals. And lately, I've become especially interested how these processes will be affected as the carbon dioxide concentration is going up, and what will happen to these processes, which include photosynthesis, respiration, calcification, and also dissolution of the calcium carbonate on the reef. So here's a figure I think probably most of you have seen, the famous Keeling curve of how the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is going up. And we have time is shown here on the x-axis, going back to 1950 up to 2010. And as you can see, the concentration of CO2 has been increasing significantly, raising from about 320 parts per million. And this year we actually crossed the 400 parts per million barrier, which is an enormous increase in a very short period of time. I put an arrow there when I started graduate school in 2001. The concentration was about 370 ppm. So it's increased by about 30 ppm in just a little bit more than 10 years. And this is, I mean, when I looked at this, I was stunned, actually. Because we're changing the system faster than we can find out things. And we need to think about this. So I hope we come up with some answers of what's going to happen before we go too far on this curve here. But it doesn't look good right now, unfortunately. So the increase in CO2 comes from a number of processes. First of all, burning of fossil fuels, deforestation, cement production, and land use changes. Okay, of the total amount of CO2 we emit to the atmosphere, there's only about 50% or 45% shown here in the upper panel that actually stays in the atmosphere. The other 50% is dispersed between the terrestrial biosphere, which takes up about 29%, and the ocean that takes up about 26%. Okay? So from a global warming perspective, this is good because the ocean is taking up a lot of the carbon dioxide. And the amount that the ocean takes up every year right now is 2.3 petagrams of carbon per year. What is 2.3 petagrams? It doesn't mean anything to me either. So it's a 2 and a 3 with a whole bunch of zeros behind it. Okay, this doesn't mean much either. Okay, so if we actually use a railroad train carrying 2.3 petagrams of carbon would stretch around the Earth 14 times. That's a lot of carbon. And that's every year. That's what the ocean takes up every year. So we are changing things big time here. So what is ocean acidification? As the carbon dioxide builds up in the atmosphere, it wants to equilibrate with the solution. So part of that CO2 is taken up by the ocean. Once the CO2 is in seawater, it will react with water to form carbonic acid, which is an acid, which then dissociates into bicarbonate and hydrogen ions. So hydrogen ions, that's our measurement of acidity. We're using the pH scale, which is the negative logarithm of the hydrogen ion concentration. But it's the increase in the hydrogen ion concentration that is why we call it ocean acidification. Some of these hydrogen ions, they also react with the carbonate ion and form more bicarbonate. Another way to show this reaction is by breaking it down into three independent reactions. So we have CO2 increasing in the atmosphere, which will result in an increase in the CO2 in the seawater. The CO2 in seawater then reacts with water to form hydrogen ions and bicarbonate. Some of the hydrogen ions then react with the carbonate ion to form bicarbonate. So some of you might ask, but how? Why does the CO2? How does it get into the ocean? So one easy demonstration you can try it at home is if you take just a can of soda, you shake it up, and you open it up, and it will spray all over the place, right? Because I mean, this is carbonic acid in here. So when you shake it, you're forcing the gas out of solution. So it builds up a pressure that's then going to push this solution out of there. If I leave it now down here for a while and come back, I can open it fine, right? So what happened is that the gas has re-equilibrated with the solution. And exactly what's happening in the atmosphere. We're putting CO2 up in the atmosphere and it's equilibrating with the ocean. These equations are not very intuitive. They're quite complicated, and sometimes we have to talk to a lot of politicians about what ocean acidification is, and it's not always easy to explain this. I used to use a demonstration to show this. So I used to take a scooter. So I have an example here when I had opportunity to talk to the former UK Foreign Secretary, David Miliband, and the former Bermuda governor, Sir Richard Gosnell. So this is when I was based in Bermuda Institute of Ocean Sciences. So I used the scooter, and you can see it at the corner of the screen there. And I would take a hose and hook it up to the scooter, put it into a tank of seawater. I put a pH meter in the tank of seawater. I would then start the scooter, so the exhaust is going into the tank of seawater, and you look at how the pH is changing. So, of course, the pH starts going down very, very rapidly. So you can really see that what's coming out of our transportation mode here is really acidifying the seawater. So it's a very, very powerful demonstration. And I was asked to do this in front of the Foreign Secretary Miliband. And as you can see, he looks quite skeptical in his facial expression here. But, you know, he observed the pH going down, and then he was like, wow. And then he said, you know what? I had a C in chemistry when I went to school. How is it that the pH is going down when CO2 dissolves into seawater? And before I had answered the question, the governor, Sir Richard Gosnell, he took a piece of paper and he wrote out this whole reaction completely. And he gave it to Miliband. And he looks at it, and then he shows it to me, and he asks me, is this correct? And I say, yeah. And the governor said, well, I had a B in chemistry. So sometimes when you least expect it, you will find people that know about carbon chemistry. So do we have evidence for this? Yes. So this is some data from 3 time series stations that we have around the world. These are open ocean time series. You can see the 3 dots here. One is at the blue one is at the Canary Islands, the red one is in Bermuda, and the green one is just off Hawaii. So what these graphs are showing here, the top one shows the CO2 concentration in both the atmosphere, that's the black line here, and in the seawater at these 3 stations. What you can see is this, the CO2 is continuously going up. You see there's a lot of wiggling, and that's the seasonal changes between summer and winter. The middle plot shows the pH, and it shows how pH is going down at all these locations. And the bottom plot shows how the carbonate ion concentration is going down. So everything that we expect from theory, we're also measuring it in the open ocean. So there's absolutely no doubt that ocean acidification is happening, and it's happening all over the oceans. So why are we concerned about ocean acidification on coral reefs? Well, corals, they build their skeletons of calcium and carbonate. So they take calcium, and there's plenty of calcium in seawater. They combine it with carbonate ions to form calcium carbonate. In an acidified world, there will be less carbonate ions. So you can think of it as they have less building material. If you have less building material, you will grow slower, and you may also produce weaker structures. Okay? A second consequence is that the breakdown or the dissolution of the calcium carbonate may even increase, actually. So you will slow down the rate at which you build your calcium carbonate. You will increase the rate at which it dissolves or breaks down. So here's a picture of a coral skeleton, where the picture here, the first one, is an intact skeleton, whereas the one to the right shows evidence of dissolution. So all the holes, part of them are from bioeroders. So these are actual organisms that are like boring into the skeleton. And it seems like this problem of dissolution might be even more important than the inability of the corals to calcify. Because the corals, they're animals. They can deal with a lot of things. But this dissolution aspect is more of a geochemical aspect and can be very detrimental to reefs. So the long-term success of a coral reef is completely dependent on the balance of the production of calcium carbonate versus the destruction of calcium carbonate. So if you're going to be a reef and provide a habitat for a lot of organisms, you need to build more calcium carbonate than you're losing. So we have corals, different types of algae, echinoderms, bryozoans, barnacles. They build their skeletons or shells of calcium carbonate. So all these organisms, they will have a harder time building these structures. Then we have bioerosion, which ranges from fish to microbes. For example, the parrotfish, which you see here, when they graze on algae growing on the reef structure, they also cut down some of the reef. Some claim that parrotfish, they can produce more than a ton of sand every year from essentially grazing on the coral. Sea urchins, same thing. And we see a sea cucumber, and they digest through the sediments to get organic matter. And doing so, they also dissolve the calcium carbonate. And the picture with the small holes on the very right, these are caused by endolithic algae. So these are small, small microorganisms living within the structure, and they purposely penetrate the reef structure. And then, of course, we also have breakdown from waves and other physical forcing. And what the middle picture here is showing is the aftermath of a hurricane going over Bermuda, bringing up all the sand and transporting it off the island. Then we also have dissolution going on within the sediments. So within the sediments, we have organic matter accumulating, and we have microbes eating this organic matter and producing carbon dioxide, which is causing conditions that then drives the dissolution of the sediments. So there's an increasing amount of evidence that's showing that the constructive processes that build calcium carbonate, they're very, very likely to decrease. The bioerosion will increase, perhaps both due to that the chemistry will be at the level where it's easier to dissolve, but also perhaps because the organisms, they're going to build weaker structures. We know from climate change that the number of storms and the intensity are likely to increase, and also the dissolution in the sediment is likely to increase. So one of the critical questions that we have now within the coral reef community is really when will coral reefs transition from being net accreting to net eroding? And the question is, I would say, not so much if this is going to happen. I think the evidence is pretty convincing that we're moving in this direction. What we don't know is the timing and how fast this will occur and what the implications of that will be. But you can imagine, if you're losing more calcium carbonate than you're building, you can no longer exist, you can no longer form a reef. But the question that's important to address then is, how fast will the reef actually break down? So there are several papers that have investigated this and made claims. For example, the top one by Dr. Silverman and his colleagues, they claim that coral reefs may start dissolving atmospheric CO2 doubles. So this is at atmospheric CO2 about 560 parts per million, and we're already at 400. So that would be probably around 2050 or even before that, so not so far into the future. Myself and my colleagues, we observed net loss of calcium carbonate from a subtropical calcifying community due to seawater acidification, and this was based on mesocosm experiments. The threshold where we observed it occurred much later than Silverman, but nevertheless, we both saw net dissolution. But again, when this will happen is the question that we need to address. So what are some of the approaches that we use to study the potential effects of ocean acidification on coral reefs? The first and perhaps most fundamental thing is that to understand what's going to happen in the future, we need to go out and see what's going on right now. So what you see here is one of our ocean acidification observing platforms or buoys. So this here is instrumented with a CO2 sensor, a pH sensor, and a whole bunch of other sensors so that we can continuously monitor how the chemistry is changing. If the government had still been open, you could have gone to a website and look at this data every day. But you get this note that, you know, it's closed for business. So I can't give you tell you to do that. But in conjunction with these measurements of what's going on right now in chemistry, we can also do different transplant experiments or look at corals at these different places to see how are they doing under different conditions and what are the major drivers of, for example, coral calcification and what is affecting the coral health. So this is just showing a plate where you have four colonies that are being incubated and they're being measured every other month. And in conjunction with that, the chemistry of the seawater is measured very carefully. Another approach is, this is an example of one of my colleagues here at Scripps, Jennifer Smith and her lab have been doing. So they have taken these triangles and going to different reef locations in different communities and see how different communities control and interact with the chemistry. So it's kind of a way of controlling your experiment, but you're still in the natural environment to see what's going on. Because every time we bring something into the lab, we want to try to make it realistic, but it's very difficult. So this is a way to bridging the gap between the lab experiment and what's happening in the natural environment. Here's another example with two of my PhD students who are here today and working in a mesocosm facility at Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. So in these tanks now we have different communities of corals, algae, some of them have sand, and they're measuring the chemistry. This is from the same experiment, but this is after the students have been up for 24 hours. And they don't look so happy. And I remember one of them saying in a quite aggravated voice, "Who came up with this idea?" And my only defense is that I didn't think it was going to get funded, but it did. So, but I was there with them, so I also suffered. But it's a beautiful sunrise here. Another approach is what another colleague here at Scripps, David Klein, has been using. And it's referred as a FOCE, or a free ocean carbon enrichment. Maybe you've heard about the FACE, which was done in terrestrial ecosystems or with forest, where you were blowing CO2 on the forest to see if it was photosynthesizing faster. It's a little bit more challenging to do this in the ocean, but these chambers that he has done here is introducing and is changing the carbon chemistry in situ on this reef. So you can use these chambers then to evaluate what's happening to corals and other organisms under natural conditions. Then in the last few years, many people have turned to these environments it's a natural CO2 vent. Okay, so we have in areas that are volcanic active, you have essentially CO2 gas bubbling up and changing the chemistry of the water. And perhaps, so the pH is much lower, so it's acidified water. And we have found these vents now. This is from Papua New Guinea, but there's also one in the Mediterranean, looking at the Mediterranean ecosystem. And there's also one in Japan that has been studied. So I wanted to show you a little video that my colleague Katarina Fabricius at the Australian Institute of Marine Science has produced. So she's doing work at these vent sites. And perhaps these vent sites that already experience elevated CO2 and lower pH, so acidified water, can provide a window into the future. So what you're seeing now is the control site, which is away from the vent sites. And what you could see there was a lot of corals, branching corals, a lot of diversity, many different species of corals. And now you see video that's getting closer and closer to these vents where you have carbon dioxide bubbling up. And as you can see, it looks very, very different. The corals are not the same. It's more of these massive porites types of corals that are they're pretty strong and can deal with a lot of things. But the diversity is much, much lower. In fact, they actually did not find a difference in the cover, the coral cover in the control region compared to the vent region. It was the same coverage of coral, but completely different species. And the diversity was much, much lower at the CO2 vent sites. Here's the coral. You can see how it's almost dissolved from the inside. And are these sites a good analogy of what's going to happen? Partly, yes, but there's also problems with them. The CO2 that's coming straight out is obviously much more concentrated than that we ever going to experience in the normal coral reefs. These reefs are also seeded by larvae from outside, so you have refugia outside. And you could see in this last picture, there was a lot of seagrasses. Okay, and the seagrasses, they're growing where you have the highest CO2 levels. So they love the CO2. And this shows that they're also going to be winners. There's not only going to be losers. So we're talking about there's going to be changes to the coral reefs as we know them, with both winners and losers. The final approach I wanted to show you how we're trying to predict what's going to happen is obviously numerical models. And this is an example of a model that forecasts the seawater chemistry. What it's showing is essentially how the carbonate ions, this important building block for corals, is changing in the ocean as the CO2 in the atmosphere, which you can see here in the upper left corner, how that is increasing. And red here means bad. That means lower concentrations of carbonate ions. And you can see how it radically changed over time. And what the small plot over to the right here shows the number of reefs sitting in something we call the aragonite saturation state. So aragonite, that's the mineral that corals build. The aragonite saturation state is what I show here on the bottom. We call it omega. It's essentially a reflection of the carbonate ion concentration and how easy it is to build calcium carbonate. So the lower the number, the harder it is to build your calcium carbonate skeletons. And as you can see, we're moving from mid-4 down to about 2. So more and more reefs, there will be in this region where it's harder and harder to build the calcium carbonate. Models like these are absolutely critical for us to predict what's going to happen in the future. However, one shortcoming is that they represent the open ocean. We have very few models, if any, that actually model the seawater chemistry on the reef. If we're looking at the reef, it's a slightly more complicated story. And this is some data from the buoys we have in Bermuda, where we have time, again on the x-axis, going back to December of 2010, up until, well, pretty much until the government shut down, because couldn't access the data after that. But what you can see, and on the y-axis we have the CO2 concentration, ranging at the bottom from 250 to a top of 650. The light blue line here, that's the atmospheric CO2 concentration, which is about 400. As you can see, in the seawater in the reef, we have big swings, very high in the summer, low in the winter, high in the summer, low in the winter, and high in the summer. You can also see big changes from day to day, and this is the diel changes. And perhaps what's most surprising to a lot of people is that for a large part of the time, the CO2 in the seawater on the coral reef is much, much higher than it is at the atmosphere today. And a lot of the predictions we do, they're based on that the seawater is in equilibrium with the atmosphere. So if we're thinking it's going to be 700 by the end of this century, you can see the reef in Bermuda is already sitting in condition in the summer of 550 to 600 ppm. So corals are already experiencing very, very high CO2, which will get higher. So there is a potential that we may underestimating the conditions that the corals will experience in the future. And the reason for these big swings, the seasonal change is partly due to temperature variation, which affects the CO2. But a big part of this swing is actually due to the reef itself, so the metabolism of the reef. So we have photosynthesis combining CO2 with water to form organic matter and oxygen during daytime when we have light. So we're pulling CO2 down during daytime. At nighttime, we have respiration that is using oxygen to remineralize organic matter and produce CO2. Then we also have calcification and dissolution. So this is the combination of calcium with carbonate to form calcium carbonate, and then the dissolution to form calcium and carbonate ions. So these processes are taking place continuously on the reef, and because reefs are shallow, these processes have a very, very strong effect on the chemistry on the reef. The net of these processes, we typically refer to as net ecosystem production, which is the difference between the photosynthesis minus the total respiration, both from autotrophic and heterotrophic organisms, and net ecosystem calcification, which is the difference between the total calcification and the total dissolution taking place on the reef. We can measure these processes, but we can only measure the net. And we can do this, we can estimate the net ecosystem production, so this is now the organic carbon production, from changes in the parameter we called DIC. And I'll tell you briefly what this is shortly. And the net ecosystem calcification we can estimate from another parameter that we can measure, which we call TA, or total alkalinity. So the DIC is equal to the sum of the concentration of CO2 plus bicarbonate and carbonate ions. Okay, we can measure that very precisely. The total alkalinity is the sum of the conservative cations. When I mean conservative cations, I talk about calcium, potassium, sodium, strontium, etc., minus the sum of the conservative anions, which includes sulfate and chloride, which we also can measure very carefully. The relevance of these parameters is that they are affected by the biogeochemical processes. So by measuring these two parameters, the DIC and the total alkalinity, we can say something about the biogeochemistry of the reef. The pH of the seawater is also a direct function of the relative concentration of these parameters. And that's what this plot is showing here. So here on the y-axis, I'm showing the total alkalinity. Okay? And on the x-axis, the DIC. So at what the color bar is showing is the pH of the seawater. So for any given combination of TA and DIC, you will have a certain pH. Okay? So now if we overlay some reaction path here of the different processes. So if we start in the middle and we have only calcification going on. Calcification is changing total alkalinity by 2 moles and the DIC by 1 mole. So it's moving down in an angle. And looking at the plot, you can see if you only have calcification, you actually decrease the pH of the seawater. On the other hand, if we only have dissolution of calcium carbonate, we're moving up in this plot. Now we're crossing the isobars, or the isoph lines here, and we are increasing the pH. Okay? Same thing is with photosynthesis. Photosynthesis takes down CO2, so pH is going up, and if we have respiration, pH is going down. Okay? So the very processes that the reef is doing all the time, they're actually affecting and changing the chemistry. So dependent on what type of community we have at the bottom, they will have a different effect on the overlying chemistry. Okay? And this becomes important if we think about how a coral reef might transition as a result of climate change and ocean acidification, moving, for example, from being dominated by calcifiers towards more macroalgae. We will modify the chemistry in a different sense between those conditions. So in the end, the actual reef could either, it could worsen the condition. If you calcify more, you're actually making the conditions worse for the reef. If you calcify less, you make them better. You alleviate the effect of ocean acidification. So the coral reef has to some extent an ability to regulate the chemistry. This approach, we can also use that to essentially take the pulse of the reef. Because if we go out to a reef and we measure these parameters, we measure the DAC, we measure the TA, we measure it across the whole reef, and I will show you an example shortly. And we look at how the slope of this line is falling on this plot. That is telling us something about the function of the reef. It's essentially telling us how carbon is cycled on the reef and how important the organic carbon cycle is versus the inorganic carbon cycle. So I'm going to show you an example. We're going to take the pulse of the Bermuda coral reef, where I have done a lot of work. So what you see here is the island of Bermuda. It looks like a fish hook. It takes about 45 minutes to drive from one end of the country to the other end, 5 minutes across, so very small. It's surrounded by a rim reef, and then there's a lagoon. If you don't know where Bermuda is located, it's the upper vertex of the Bermuda Triangle, okay? And the other corners being Florida and Puerto Rico. So since 2007, we've been running a research program in Bermuda, referred to as the Bermuda Ocean Acidification and Coral Reef Investigation. And one of the objectives of this was to really, really characterize the seawater chemistry. So what you see here overlaid on the map is that you have the two big triangles. That's the buoy locations, where you have the buoys and they're measuring chemistry every 3 hours all the time. But that only covers two places. The white squares, those are from a time series we've been running since 2007, where we go out every month and collect samples across this transect. And the yellow dots, those are stations that we do every other year or so, covering the whole platform, going in a lawnmower pattern, essentially trying to look at the spatial variation in the chemistry across the platform. Are we the first one that has done this? No, not really. There's a paper from 1920 where this gentleman, Crozier, he was actually a medical doctor, and he went to Bermuda on vacation, and as we all do when we go on vacation, he brought his pH meter. And he measured pH across the Bermuda platform. And I'm going to read to you here. It's kind of bad quality.
He says that some distinct indications were had of a seasonal variation in pH of the enclosed waters, but tidal and other diurnal complications in the lagoons would make it necessary to institute a long series of studies for a complete description of this phenomenon.
So about 100 years later, we got funding to do that. So let's look at how the chemistry varies on the Bermuda platform. So the two top panels here, this shows the TA, or the total alkalinity of the water. And the two bottom panels, they show the DIC, or the dissolved inorganic carbon of the platform. To the left is data from the winter, and to the right is data from the summertime. If we start looking at the wintertime, you can see here there is essentially the same color. It's all red, almost, with some minor changes, both with respect to the total alkalinity and respect to the DIC. So there are no gradients across the Bermuda platform in the wintertime. In the summertime, on the other hand, we can see there's a big difference in both alkalinity and DIC. So there's a strong drawdown of both these parameters. And that is an effect of the reef metabolism. So we have photosynthesis and we have calcification, and they're drawing down both the DIC and the alkalinity. If we look at a contour map of pH, we'll see that the pH in the wintertime is slightly higher than it is in the summertime, where the pH is lower. But both in the wintertime and the summertime, there are no strong gradients in pH. It's fairly uniform, and perhaps that's what we'd expect for the wintertime. But in the summertime, where there were so strong gradients in both TA and DIC, but there's no gradient in the pH. The reason for this is that the processes are balanced. Okay? So if we look here at the plot again, the rainbow plot, where we have alkalinity on the y-axis and DIC on the x-axis, to the very right, the upper part of the plot, that shows data from offshore. Okay? So offshore has the highest alkalinity and the highest DIC. The green data, that shows data from the wintertime. As we're moving across the platform, so as the water comes to the platform and flows over, the corals are calcifying, photosynthesizing, and they're taking up total alkalinity and DIC. They're pulling down both TA and DIC, which is being depleted. But because they're taking them up in equal proportions, you can see that it's not crossing any lines of equal pH. The pH stays constant. So even though the reef has a very strong effect on the seawater chemistry, there's no net change in the pH because of this balance of the processes. So the question now is really, what's going to happen in the future with acidification? So as the ocean takes up more CO2, the DIC is going to go up. So this is now, we acidify the ocean, there's more DIC, so this whole plot is just moving up to the right at a lower pH conditions. But in this scenario, that means that there's no changes to the biogeochemical processes. And if there's no effect, then we have nothing to worry about. But is this what's going to happen, or will this relationship change? So one of the big questions we're working on right now is really, how will this relationship change? If you change the community composition on the reef, you may change it in a way that the reef, to some extent, could counteract the ocean acidification, or perhaps worsen it. But these are things we're working on right now, and it's work in progress, essentially. So I have no idea how long I've been talking. So I'll sum up with some conclusions, and I'll take some questions after that. So coral reefs are likely to transition from net accretion to net erosion. The trend is very robust. However, when this will happen, how fast it will happen, and what are the implications that happen, we don't know. Those are research questions we're really trying to find out. We can use measurements of chemical parameters essentially to take the pulse of different coral reefs. So right now we're working a lot in the process to understand what these different slopes between the DAC and TA means and how they will change in the future and how they're different from different coral reef environments. We're also seeing that the biogeochemical processes, they modify the seawater CO2 chemistry on the reefs very significantly. And this could perhaps alleviate the effect of ocean acidification to some extent, or even worsen it, depending on how these processes are changing. And I wanted to think about this problem, and I always get the question, what can we do about this? And there's only one way to stop ocean acidification. There's no shortcuts to that. And that is only to cut or slow down the rate of emission. There's no way we can get at it without doing that. And the key here is really to slow down. I'm pretty sure we're probably going to burn everything we have. But if we can do it slower, that would be good. There are other things that can be done at the local scale, though. For example, a coral reef experiences a lot of different stressors from human activities. There's overfishing, sedimentation, pollution, disease, etc. The list goes on. The whole, when you have many stressors acting at one, the reef and the organism there have a harder time dealing with a problem. So some of these problems we can actually deal with and perhaps can buy some time. So we need to do solutions both at the global scale, dealing with the CO2 emissions, finding alternative energy sources, but there's also stuff that people can do at the local and regional scale. And I stop there and happy to answer any questions. Thank you. So the question was whether I can comment on changes associated with temperature changes related to El Niño and also Pacific Decadal Oscillation and North Atlantic Oscillation and how that affects coral bleaching. So bleaching, that's a huge problem. We're still dealing with it. It hasn't gone away, even though you hear less about it. There was actually a bleaching event just now in Bermuda. And I don't know if you heard about this Catlin Seaview, where they have this big camera rig. David Klein here at Scripps is involved with that. And they flew over there and they took images of the reef. And I think it's available online. But anyway, that's a side. The warming is a huge problem. And as the temperature gets too high, corals, they have symbionts living with them, so algae that are photosynthesizing. When it gets too hot, these symbionts are expelled and the corals bleach. It's the symbionts that give the corals the color. Okay, so when they don't have the symbionts anymore, the corals don't get as much energy. And if the bleaching only occurs for a short period of time, the corals may recover, they may regain the symbionts. But if it's for an extended period of time, they will die. And there's been many, many examples of detrimental coral bleaching events.
Which does affect the dissolution rate of calcium carbonate?
Absolutely. So the comment now, will that affect the dissolution rate of the calcium carbonate? If you have bleaching, you will calcify less, okay? So your positive term in building the reefs will be lower, okay? So the dissolution term will be higher, and subsequently moving into where you may have a reef that is losing more calcium carbonate than what it's producing. So if you don't have healthy corals, they're also more vulnerable to these bioeroders to break down. And once a reef has bleached and died, it can break down in a very, very short time. There's some estimates in as short as 10 years. Okay, so the two of them working together, both bleaching and ocean acidification, can be very detrimental. There are other sides, though, to these changes in climate as well. For example, if you have the North Atlantic Oscillation, there's a lot of changes with the productivity, depending on so the North Atlantic Oscillation, essentially, it's the variation of two pressure systems. So the Iceland low and the Bermuda high, and they're moving up and down. So depending on this cycle, you may be in a strong negative phase or a weak negative phase. And at certain phases, you induce more mixing. And And this brings more nutrients up to the surface ocean, and you stimulate productivity. So there's more food in the water. And this could actually have a beneficial effect on the corals. But this is one. This really comes back to one of the big challenges we have as scientists in trying to figure out what are the natural processes taking place. We have, you could see, big seasonal changes. Well, we have daily changes to seasonal changes to decadal natural changes. And in the background of these very rapid, large changes, we have this anthropogenic change in both temperature and CO2 that's going on. And we're trying to detect what that signal will do to the reefs. So, any other questions? The two questions were the first one, whether erosion or the breakdown of the reef is something new and we haven't seen that before. Right. And the second one was whether the pH has not been this low in 300 million years. So I start with number two here. We can't say for 300 million years. We know for sure, or more or less, that it hasn't been this low for the past 1 million years. We know that for sure. Okay? We can even go further back. We can probably go back 55 million years. That it hasn't been this low until going back 55 million years. In 55 million years, we had an event called the Paleo-Eocene Thermal Maximum, and there was a big burp, a release of carbon to the atmosphere, and it changed the chemistry radically, and we saw extinction of calcifying organisms referred to as foraminifera, which are single cellular, and live in the ocean. Almost 90% of those were extinct. So there were some very drastic consequences to that acidification event. However, there were other changes associated with that as well, with temperature and perhaps oxygen as well. And it's hard to say exactly what caused the extinction. But we have exactly those same changes happening now as well, both with temperature and oxygen. The big difference, though, is that even the PETM boundary is referred to as a rapid geological event. It happened over several thousand years, about the same amount of CO2 that we will release in a matter of 200 to 300 years happened over several thousand years. So, yeah. In terms of the first question, the erosion and dissolution of coral reefs is something that's ongoing. It's nothing new. It's always been taking place. But the balance or the accumulation of the reef is a very fine balance where you calcify a little. They're very close to one another, actually. So small changes may tip one way or the other. And there are reefs. There are examples of reefs that are losing more mass than they're producing. In Bermuda, for example, in the wintertime, I showed you there was no gradients in total alkalinity, for example. That means that in the wintertime, right now in Bermuda, it's right at that threshold where it's losing more calcium carbonate than it's producing. It's producing a lot of calcium carbonate in the summer, so it's not there yet where the whole reef will start losing. But you can imagine if there's a big bleaching event and you kill off a big significant fraction of the corals, then you may make that transition. But it's a gradual change that will happen, essentially. So it's nothing new. Dissolution happens all the time. It's just that the way things are going now and the evidence we have is at some point they're going to cross and the dissolution is going to exceed the calcification. We still don't know, once you make that threshold, exactly what that means, because that depends on how fast the dissolution will take place. Anyone else in the back? Or that's a very good question. So the question was whether the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere, the rate of change has been increasing over time. And the question was, have we seen the same in the ocean? And the answer to that is actually... to show I get it right there. No, well, so the buffer capacity of the ocean has actually been, the more CO2 we take up in the ocean, the capacity to take up more CO2 is decreasing. So the rate of the uptake in the ocean has actually been going down. Okay, so the slope, the ability of the ocean to act as a sink of the CO2 is going down as it takes up more CO2. So part of the fact that you may see, and well, part of the increase in the atmosphere is because the rate has been increasing, right? But if we would keep the rate constant, you would not, the atmosphere would keep still increasing faster because the capacity of the ocean to take up CO2 would actually go down with more CO2. And the same is with warming. The warmer the water is, the less CO2 it can hold. Yeah.
Do you see a point at which the pH will drop no further than if it's already starting to decrease?
Well, it's only the rate, okay? I mean, and that is assuming if you had a constant, you will see a level off. The pH will not decrease as fast. It will start slowing down. But it will still equilibrate with atmosphere. And the pH will continue to decrease as long as we put CO2 into the atmosphere. So if we burn all of the fossil fuel, all the conventional fossil fuels, it's likely the average ocean pH will be about 7.5. Okay? So the ocean will still not be acidic, right, from that perspective. But let me give you an example. From pre-industrial times, the pH was about 8.2. Okay? Right now, we're about 8.1. That's an increase in the acidity of the ocean of 30%. That's a major change. Okay? If we continue to burn at the increasing rate we do right now, by the end of this century, the pH will be about 7.8. And that's a 100 to 150% increase in the acidity. So very, very big changes.
Big round of applause for us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.